East Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. This is a very exciting day, Jim.
It's a big day.
Big day, big day.
Specifically at 4 o'clock today, which we'll air live here on GBH, Tom Menino will make it official this morning outside his home in Hyde Park. He came pretty close.
A sad day, but a day that always will come in your career.
It must be such a hard decision now.
Oh, it's a very difficult decision, you know. when you have something you really love, you lived 24/7 for the last 20 years. It's tough to say no, but the time and place for everything.
Wonder who was laughing in the background. Was that Angela Menino? In any case, Tom Menino did leave himself a little bit of wiggle room.
I might change at 4 o'clock, you never know. I might say something different. I'll pull a Kevin White.
Joining us in studio.
That was Dot Joyce laughing.
What's that? Was
that
it?
Sounded like
Dot
her.
Joyce's
yeah.
press person. Yeah. That's nervous laughter, meaning what am I going to do next? In any case, that voice you just heard was our colleague, host of Greater Boston, on which Tom Menino did his last major sit-down interview last week. Hey, Emily Rose.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
Fine. So you did have a really long, extensive interview with him. And did you think this was going to be one of his swan song interviews?
Well, I mean, I knew the deadline was close, and also I asked him, I pressed him on it, you know, when are you gonna let people know? And he says that day is coming, so it had to be somewhere before April 17th, we knew that. But, boy, you know, I gotta say, he was so feisty in that interview. And, you know, he got all riled up when, and he kept bringing up John Connolly, not me. I brought him up once, and he kept, you know, that guy and this and that, and, you know, he doesn't, what's the record that he's running on, and what's, and I got a record to point to, and I think this came to him very, very kind of suddenly, maybe even within the last few days. I had someone tell me that he had a recent consultation with his doctors who just said, you know what, it isn't a good idea. I mean, I think he was really pained to do this.
I bet you are absolutely right, because I was talking to someone yesterday that had been in a room with him and talking about his difficulty getting around, difficulty getting out of a chair, massaging his leg, looking like he was in pain. So how do you run, especially with a poll that says as much as people love him, and, you know, 75% to 80%, depending on which poll you look at, say they love him. Many significant numbers in those polls were saying, well, we don't know if he should run again for office as much as we do know.
I thought that part of the poll was total BS, by the way.
I thought the part
that said maybe it's time for somebody new,
yeah.
I think it expressed nothing other than the fact they were concerned, does he have the physical stamina?
No.
When a guy's 75 to 19 or whatever it was, a popular approval, you don't think that's
I think people were concerned that he was going to leap into this and not be able to do it, and no one wanted to see that, which is why people polled probably said, you know, don't do it.
And in a poll the mayor commissioned himself, which the Herald reported this morning Joe Battenfeld did, that poll found that more than a third said they probably or definitely vote for someone else this fall. That's a big deal. And Menino commissioned that himself, aware that he was in trouble. What do you think?
You know, you got to get 50% to win an election. That's
I know
a third of people. And there's
that's
no
significant
but
numbers.
But Marjorie, there's no political race ever where a third to 40% of
Jim,
the people don't oppose
Jim,
the incumbent.
Once a third of the people saw a mayor that was having difficulty getting around, couldn't campaign like you used to, then it would rise from 30 to 40 to 50.
Running is literal. I mean, you've got to be on your game. You got to be moving around. You got to be, you know, dancing on the stage. You got to be moving. And I mean, I sat with him. He was in great spirits, by the way. And, you know, I left the room for a minute. He said, come on back here. I have something else I want to tell you. But I mean, he, you know, was having a hard time getting out of the chair. And it was a straight back chair. You know, it was his, like, it had the little mayoral insignia on it. He couldn't do it by himself.
Throughout the day today, we're going to talk to a lot of people who know him really well, some who might run to succeed him, some who ran against him. But for now, if you want to give us a buzz at 877-301-8970, it's 877-301-8970. What's the legacy of Tom Menino for you? What's your sense of his 20 years in office? And who's likely to join the list of would-be successors? I did an analysis this morning, Emily, admittedly, back of the envelope. The only person I know who lives in Boston who is not thinking of running is you. Is
that well, I just want to tell you all a personal note. I've said this on probably Greater Boston before, but Tom Menino was a great, great personal friend of my deceased husband, Kirby Perkins. Kirby cultivated him when he was a city councilor. You know, back in the days when you actually sit.
You're kidding. You're kidding.
Kirby went to City Hall every single day. And Tom Menino was the guy he latched onto.
Why?
And so I don't know. But, I mean, it was almost like, you know, it was just one of those things. It was just So Tom was very, very close to Kirby and was crushed when he died. And I think by extension, always felt very, you know, close to me in a way. Like he always made sure, you know, that sort of like this, he took care of me in terms
right.
of the interviews and all that because of his relationship with my husband.
Well, that was almost prescient, though, because this is, of course,
yeah,
one of the
was.
Great ironies of Tom Menino's career is that he was totally underestimated.
Oh, yeah.
In 1993, I think it was, when he was appointed the mayor. Was it 93 or 93?
No, appointed because he was chair of the city, president
okay.
of the city council.
Right,
he
was appointed when Ray Flynn went off to become ambassador to the Vatican. Everybody thought that he was going to be the caretaker
mm-hmm.
mayor and
mm-hmm.
be blown out of
blown
the water
out.
In the November election.
Mm-hmm.
So your husband saw something
yeah,
in Tom Menino.
Years even before 93. He latched on to him in the 80s.
And was it because he thought he was
going to
be...
He knew everything.
He knew everything.
He was a go-to guy. And you know, the mayor, he kind of likes to talk. He was a go-to guy. And he definitely had his pulse on the beat of the city. And, you know, he gave him stuff.
Yeah.
Urban mechanic, even then. 877-301-8970. Roughly half of the people in the Globe poll the other day and close to 60% of the people in a poll 4 years ago said they had personally met the mayor. If you're amongst them and you have a story, not unlike Emily's, give us a buzz. And I've told this story before. Well, in our former lives, we were talking about a great project that Tom Menino was spearheading called Camp Harborview, which
oh, yeah.
is this thing for poor kids in the city to go to this island on Boston Harbor.
Right.
Most of the kids who live a mile away had never even seen Boston Harbor. He was on our show. When the show was over, Marjorie and I were trying to help him raise money for it, that sort of thing. He called and said, "Do you want to go out tomorrow with me?"
Yeah, yeah.
And Marjorie couldn't go, and I went out with him the next day. The most amazing part of this, and I'm not exaggerating, I would say every single kid in this camp, including tiny little kids,
yeah, yeah.
knew Tom Menino.
Yeah, oh.
Didn't know him from the camp, but they said, "Hey, Tom, you were in my neighborhood. Hey, Tom, you came
yeah.
to my house." The most poignant moment was when a little kid said, "Hey, Mr. Mayor," he said, "you came to my house a few weeks ago." And the mayor said, "Why?"
Oh.
And he said, just totally matter-of-factly, he says, "You know, my brother was murdered a couple
yeah.
of, and you came and you took care of my mom and my mom." You know, it's just the guy had the human touch despite all the jokes about the, you know, the language and
mm-hmm.
the lack of eloquence, including jokes he made about himself. The guy really had the popular touch.
Well, you know what else? And you would know about this, Emily. He was ahead of his time in a whole lot of ways. He, very early, when the AIDS epidemic was still raging, back in the late 80s and before he even became the mayor, he was big on, you know, condom distribution, big on gay rights stuff. He was a very early supporter of gay marriage. You wouldn't think a guy out of Hyde Park, Reedville, would be so progressive.
And his Catholic background.
Exactly.
I mean, for a guy who really has just, we can face this and say this honestly, an ornery streak. Because he gets
ornery.
Mad really, really
oh,
easily.
Yes.
He was incredibly open and accessible to ideas. And listen, I mean, even this building, you guys don't know this, but the first time somebody came to him with the plans, he says, "That's ugly." He says, "No." And somebody went back and they did that LED thing. And so he had his fingers in absolutely everything. So, I mean, he doesn't look like or sound like somebody who's got that kind of vision, but he does.
Yeah, he does. And when you think about it, there was a story today in I don't know if it was the Globe or the Herald, talking about he was interviewed in Boston Magazine saying, "What's your vision?" He said, "Well, my vision is good jobs, better schools, and an improved city." And you live in the city of Boston. I used to live in the city of Boston. It is remarkably better. I mean, you even go to the toughest neighborhoods of Boston, the Grove Hall section of Roxbury, look nothing like they looked 20 mm-hmm. years ago. Dudley Square looks nothing like it looked. Rosendale Square looks nothing like it looks.
The waterfront.
The waterfront. The south end of Boston, which used to be Hooker Haven, because mm-hmm. the Herald used to be down there, is now like Soho, the art galleries and all the high-end kind
of. It was Hooker Haven because the Herald used to be down there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's a famous story about the hookers used to hang out in the corner and, you know, pull up their shirts and people would drive by and give him $30. You know, I mean, it was a very dangerous neighborhood. No more.
Mm. He is somebody who really was true to his word about getting out into the neighborhoods, because you really wondered about some of the other mayors and, frankly, city councilors, whether they're that familiar with every, you know, neighborhood in the city. Mayor Tom Menino really is. I can remember once, I always telling him that the city's dirty. I still say, you know, my God, it drives me crazy. You know, walk through, you know, the intersection of Newbury and Dartmouth, there's just tons of litter and, you know, coffee cups and cigarettes. And oh, by the way, there's a water fountain that's been pushed over and lying on its side, a big cement thing. It's been there since I moved in. He says, "Really? Where is it?" He gets out a notepad and paper, writes it down. gone the next day.
Is that really so?
Absolutely.
877-301-8970. We're talking about Tom Menino. 4 o'clock today, he will announce that he's not running for a sixth term at Faneuil Hall. We will carry that live here on WGBH. In the interim, we're looking for your recollections. What's the legacy? Did you ever meet him? Who do you think's on the short list or long list of possible successors? Let's start in Hyannis with Kevin. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim, Marjorie, and Emily. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks.
Hey, I just want to say, you know, the great thing about Mumbles is that, you know, he's the rarest of all politicians. He has the job he wants. He doesn't want to be governor.
Amen.
You know, I don't think there's another politician in the state you can say that about.
Good point.
I mean, yeah, that's a great point.
He didn't care about being a governor, doesn't want to be a congressman. He just wanted to be mayor. And, I mean, that shows, and it's why he's so liked.
I think that's a great analysis, Kevin. Thank you for the call.
It enabled him to be sincere in a way that many politicians can't, who always say,
true,
oh, I'm only looking at this job right now. And, of course, they're looking at,
yeah, right,
17 other jobs. So that was a big deal, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you go back to all the other – even Ray Flynn, who I think we thought would probably be mayor for life when temptation came calling with the ambassadorship to the Vatican, he took it. Let's face it, Mayor White had designs on the White House.
Exactly.
And higher office in Massachusetts. None of that ever worked out for him. But Mayor Menino not even a peep.
But, you know, that's a great comparison, because I think when Ray Flynn, of course, great basketball player, but a guy from the neighborhood, South Boston, Kevin White always had that, you know, lace curtain Irish, kind of a little Brahmin veneer there, even though he was an Irishman. I mean, that's a great comparison. Whose legacy, who made more of a difference in Boston? Kevin White, who created Faneuil Hall? Tom Menino, who created the waterfront, who has improved the schools. Of course, Kevin White was there in the mayor's office when busing went through Boston. Who's made more of an impact?
Well, I think Kevin White really made Boston more of a world-class city. He brought a dignity and an elegance that we really needed at the time. I mean, Tom Menino is something completely different. He's brought us through, you know, great development, and he's made the city much more livable. But Kevin White really put it on the map in a way that we needed at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Our numbers are – what are the numbers, Jim?
877-301-8970.
I should also get the email address, which is BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org, if you guys want to weigh in on what you think about Tom Menino and his legacy to the city of Boston.
You know, I have to say, I'm still pretty shocked. I mean, even though
– I'm shocked, too.
You found out, yesterday afternoon or something?
Yeah, I got a call yesterday afternoon.
And I heard about it right at the end of the debate. I got a text. You found out yesterday afternoon.
Funny.
You obviously wrote your column
about
it.
You know, in the newspaper business, of course, you can't – we're writing the stories at 6 o'clock last night, 7 o'clock last night. So you have to be sure.
Yep.
And we weren't sure at 7 or 8 o'clock. So we had to wait until
later. Everybody remember the infamous Peter Lucas 1984 White Will Run. And, of course, White did not run.
Yeah, that was not a happy day for the Boston Herald. We didn't want to repeat that sort of thing, so we didn't know. But there's a lot of speculation now about what happens. John Conley, of course, he's a city councilor. He's announced he's going to run for mayor. A lot of people haven't, but there's great speculation. Michael Ross, another city councilor from the Back Bay, speculation he might
run. I think
run.
With the city council, you do the opposite. You don't name who's running. You name who's not running. I'm serious. Which city councilor? This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Which city councilor on that list is not going to take a crack at this?
I think a lot of them. I'm not even sure about Stephen Murphy. You think Steve Murphy will
President of the city council? I would say the answer is yes. I don't have any inside information.
I think Dan Connolly is definitely in.
The DA. Suffolk County DA.
And Felix Arroyo. Many people have said that Felix Arroyo Jr., who's the son, of course,
who will be here tomorrow, by the way.
He's going to be on the news quiz about Menino. His son of Felix Arroyo that was on the council for years. I believe his father was the first Latino ever elected
Sounds
to
right.
the city council. Felix Jr., very popular guy. He might run for office.
Mm. That's I don't know. I mean, it takes – you don't have that much time. You got to get a lot of money. You got to get the signatures. I mean, the whole thing is like on a fast track right now.
Yeah.
It's November. It's already the end of March.
Conley does have a lot of money.
Let me give you three possible long shots, and then we have a caller I want to take in a second. One, Paul Grogan, head of the Boston Foundation, has wanted for a long time. He hasn't said anything yet today. Two, Andrea Cabral, former head of Suffolk County.
Yep.
She's actually going to call us, sheriff of Suffolk County, going to call us later. Here's my long shot. How about Steve Lynch? Now, Abby, one of our colleagues today, texted or emailed Steve Lynch's PR person and said, what's the possibility of a switch to mayor? The response from his communications director was, ha ha, no, was the answer. I don't think it should be written off, Steve Lynch. I think he'd like to be mayor. In any case, before we continue this conversation, 877-301-8970, here's what Tomanino once said about our next guest. Quote, the thing you have to give him a lot of credit for, he works hard, he's out in the neighborhood, he's out talking. It's like he's running for city council. He's out shaking hands at every event that's possible. He shows up. And now we'll see if that guy returns the compliment. The guy joining us is former United States Senator Scott Brown. Good morning and good afternoon, Senator Brown.
Hey, good morning, everybody. How are you?
Hey, excellent, thanks.
Hey, Scott. So you've been in the business. You're not anymore, but you have been for a while. What do you think the success of Menino is all about?
I think it's about his ability to connect with the everyday person, showing up at events, being there, being accessible, meeting folks. That personal touch is very, very important in the city as a mayor or as a city councilor.
What kind of you seem to have an incredibly close relationship with him. He seemed to have an affinity for you. Obviously, he was a big-time loyal Democrat. You were a Republican. But there was a personal closeness. Was there not, Scott Brown?
Yeah, listen, when I worked very hard, I've known the mayor for, I think, about 15 years. Didn't agree with him on everything, but have a lot of respect for him and what he's done, his work ethic in particular. While we didn't agree on everything, the things that we agreed on, we tried to work zealously together on, and the things we didn't, we just respectfully disagreed.
Scott, we always got the impression right at the end there anyway that he was secretly rooting for you over Elizabeth Warren. What do you
That's
think?
What I
think
I thought.
He was. I think he was.
We thought so. Yeah, listen, I don't know. I know there was a tremendous amount of pressure put on by the administration. And when he came back from the convention, he was different. And I understand. I get it. I understand politics. But listen, bottom line is he has a legacy he should be proud of. And as I said, I didn't agree with him on everything, but we found a common bond. I always considered him a friend, somebody that I would trust. And whoever takes his position will have very, very big shoes to fill.
Well, you know, you mentioned, Scott, how hard Menino worked and how he showed up at events. The legendary stories about Scott Brown, I mean, I remember being at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. You were there before it began with your whole family, greeting everybody, posing for pictures.
With
you were
a
there.
Thousand Democrats
yes,
in the room.
You were there long after it was over, and your opponent, Elizabeth Warren, kind of showed up late and left early, and I think Joe Kennedy was there for about 5 minutes. So in that sense, because you campaigned a lot the way Mayor Menino did. Was he in some ways a mentor?
No. I just like people. I mean, I've always liked people. You know, I've always liked people. I've always enjoyed learning about what they're doing, and it's so exciting to meet someone you have nothing in common with and find that common ground that you know, way to kind of bond together. And I don't know everything, and I'm always willing and excited to learn. And going to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast as probably one of the only Republicans, aside from you, Jim.
Thank you, Senator.
You know, Scott, one of the things...
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I missed it this year. It was a lot of fun.
Trust me, you were missed, Senator Brown. Hey, Scott Brown.
I'm sorry.
Menino said this morning, and it was tough. He hasn't made his formal announcement yet, but he says it's really tough to say no. Can you identify with that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, when I was in the recent election, all the polls had me up 22, 23 points, give or take, and I felt I would have had a pretty good shot of winning, at least been in the thick of things. But there comes a point when you look at the lay of the land. In my case, I had been running since this would have been my, 11th election in the last 15 years, because every state rep, state senate election is every 2 years, and every one of them was obviously kind of a bloodbath, you know, being a Republican from Massachusetts. And then doing a special election, then a general, and then another special, and then another general. Like I said, I think I would have had a good shot to win.
Yeah.
The thought of just running again almost the next day and running again in a little over a year, it's like, why?
Hey,
you know,
Senator.
When I have the ability to get on your show and other shows and continue to speak and advocate and press the both sides to do it better, I think I have a better forum right now for a little while.
Hey, Senator Brown, what were you doing last night between 7 and 8?
I was in the North End, actually.
You weren't watching the GOP and Democratic debate for the U.S. Senate?
No, I was actually having a lovely dinner with my wife and enjoying life.
Boy, I'll tell you.
You'll miss it. I don't know.
I think the senators in the majority that may have missed the debate last night.
Yeah, I'd like to see the ratings on that one.
We'll send it to you. Senator Brown, Scott Brown, we really appreciate your time. Thanks
all right, guys.
So much.
Have fun.
Congratulations on your new situation, Senator Brown.
My new jobs?
Yes. Your jobs, yes.
Yes.
Scott Brown,
right,
take care.
Thanks,
we appreciate
guys.
Your calling in. Our number is 877-301-8970. That was a great question, actually. Yeah. I mean, he lived through the exact same kind of experience, obviously, for different reasons, but that was good. Let's go to Acton, where Bob is on with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and Emily Rooney. Hey, Bob. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Bob. Oops.
Nicely put.
I don't know what happened to
Bob. Thank you for the call. So, Emily, we haven't talked about... I threw out my Steve Lynch, Paul Grogan, Andrew Cabral axis. Who's not on everybody's list who you think is a possible entrant in this race?
Greg Selko? No.
Greg Selko, who's going to join us later, head of Carmaloop, head of the Boston Future Alliance. Did he endorse Connolly? He was at Connolly's event. I think
sure
he was.
About that.
Yeah. So who is?
There could be people that we don't know about in the business community. But as I said earlier, it's so late to get into it. I think you're going to see some of the usual suspects. I don't think Andrea Cabral is going to get into this.
Neither do I.
Got named a new state position. I don't think so.
The two people we've got tomorrow on the news quiz are people that are talked about.
Felix Arroyo and Tito Jackson.
Tito Jackson's a very dynamic guy. He's very charming. He's got a lot of energy. Young guy, smart guy, got a lot of thoughts about how the city should be improved. He's, of course, a city councilor. Felix Arroyo, again, a very popular city councilor. You know, Ayanna Pressley topped the ticket last time around, but I don't see her at all running for mayor, even though she did very well when she ran for city council, was reelected to the council.
Can I tell you why I disagree with you guys? And I was proven wrong in an exactly similar situation.
It's okay,
obviously,
Jim.
My view on the United States Senate thing is I thought there were going to be about 3,000 candidates. And the reason for that is when you have one seat that doesn't open for 30 years, another that hadn't opened for 40 years, Ted Kennedy's, you figure everybody's going to get in. So I was wrong there. Obviously, it's a fairly limited field. Most people thought this guy was going to be mayor another 10, maybe another 12 years. You don't think, Emily Rooney, when people see this may be the one opportunity, particularly if a 40-year-old is elected and serves for 20 years,
people are just going to put themselves out there and they don't have that much time to get themselves well-known and there's just not that many opportunities and to raise the money. I mean, it's...
And what does the mayor make, $150,000?
Nothing. I don't
know. It's not a lot of money for a colossal...
I think if you have young children or you have a big mortgage in the city of Boston, it's not easy to get by to raise a family of four or five people on $150,000.
I mean, I don't mean to say it's nothing, but I think it's, you know, for a job like that...
It's hard.
You're working 24/7, it's not that much.
No, I don't think it is either.
It's not like Tom May, you know?
No, it's not the $9 million.
Tom May, for those who know, former head of NSTAR, now head of Northeast Utilities, who's, I guess, $8 or $9 or $10 million a year
man. This is an unpopular position, I know, but to me we should pay the governor and the mayor more than they do.
And judges.
They
don't make enough.
They have 8 weeks vacation.
There she goes with the vacation.
I'm always monitoring the vacation angle.
The number is 877-301-8970. We'd love you to weigh in on Tom Menino, who's announcing at 4 o'clock today. You'll hear the announcement live on Boston Public Radio that he is not running for a sixth term. What I started to say before, and I don't know if that's when Scott Brown called in or I just lost my train of thought. I'm still amazed. You know, it's one of those things where intellectually, you know, the guy's not running. Obviously, he's not running. It is amazing to me that Tom Menino has given this all the jokes
at the St. Patrick's Day
breakfast.
It's his health. He had major problems. He's got diabetes. He can't get around that well anymore. I would guess, and I have no inside information, that he's been told, as you said, by his doctors.
I think his doctor said this. I don't think they said don't do it. I think they said this is not a good idea.
Yeah,
you're on the road to, you know, recovery. Don't set yourself back.
He talked about his grandkids this morning, too. In fact, we have another bite that's more about the state of the city. Is this also from this morning, people? This is from, I think it's from his event, his press availability outside his house at Hyde Park. Let's hear a little bit more of that.
It's been a great time. It's a changed city, and I'm glad that I've been a small part of this changed city. It's a 20 years, and remember when I started, the city was a boat, and today what it is, a city of vitality, young city, between the age of 20 and 34, 1 in 3 Boston residents between the age of 20 and 34. Much different city than I took over.
You know, that's a big significant point about Menino as well, that the white population of Boston has gotten older. The younger population is much more diverse, and he's popular among those younger, diverse populations. Very popular in the black community, very popular in the Latino community.
70% plus of the black vote.
Yeah, and again, you know, one of my friends at the Herald said he was like a hipster before his time in terms of the gay community, too. You don't think of him as being a hipster, but a really progressive guy. Let's go to Robert from Lowell. You are on 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH. Thanks for calling.
Hey there.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment about the mayor. You know, in an era when we see so many corrupt politicians and when so much power in the hands of one person, you know, often corrupts them, here was a mayor who, you know, always had the little guy's back, always cared about the city and did the right thing for the city, and, you know, wasn't acting for himself. A really selfless guy, and I'd love to see him run the city from a hospital bed, if that's all he can do.
You know, Robert, that is a great point. I think Brian McGrory had it in his column.
I'm about to read
usually,
it. He says,
yeah, go ahead.
There are many. Brian wrote a front page column. He'll be with us in the 1 o'clock hour, too. There are many good reasons for these numbers, meaning the huge popularity. One more important than the rest. This newspaper, no newspaper, publishes stories with any regularity. Headline, quote, still no corruption in City Hall, which is a pretty good line.
And no federal grand juries and no, you know, no shady birthday parties like there were with Kevin White. No allegations, no people going to jail. You know what is significant, though, and different from Kevin White's administration? Markedly different. All the superstars that came out of Kevin White's administration.
That's true.
Congressman Barney Frank came out of Kevin White's administration. Ira Jackson, who had a great career in banking, and I think he's in academics now, came out of his administration. Meacho Spring.
Paul Lyons.
Exactly.
Peter Mead, who went from the media now to be head of the BRA.
And he was at Blue Cross before that. Who are the people that came out of Menino's administration? I can't think of any. Am I missing someone?
Emily's thinking. For those who are not watching us on TV,
George
Regan was Kevin White.
Kevin White, that's what I mean. He came out of Kevin White's administration too.
I mean, the people who he kept a tight rein on the people who worked around him. I mean, he had some loyal people who he deals with every day who call him and fill him in on stuff. But you're right. None of them became superstars.
So let me ask you something. In this campaign, whoever enters it, whether it's a limited field as you suggest, Emily, or a larger field as I think it's going to be. It seems to me the contest is going to be who loved Tom Menino more than the other candidates.
It's going to be like the Ted Kennedy thing.
It really is. When John Connolly entered the race, I was mocking the fact that in his announcement, he said, when we thought Menino was running, great guy, love the mayor, has done great things. However, this morning, that's all Connolly was saying, greatest mayor in the history of Boston. And I think he actually probably believes it, but it's going to be this attempt to get as close to Tom Menino. And at the end
you
of the day,
so? Today only.
Does he embrace? Oh, I don't. I think the guy, he's going to be in office. Don't think there's going to be a farewell tour?
Well, and they're also
during election
be seeking his endorsement. He probably
won't
endorse anybody.
I don't think he will either.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, there's some talk that he's very close with Rob
Consalvo.
That is a city councilor who's also been named as a possible
contender. You know what I always wondered about all these 20 years when, you know, there's a fair amount of crime and violence in, you know, a couple of specific neighborhoods in Boston. And you said, Jim, that you saw that story personally where the mayor actually went to the house of somebody, a young kid whose brother had been murdered. How he dealt with that, like, emotionally, internally, because when he was public about it, I mean, it was almost kind of amusing. He'd say, we're not going to let the city be ruined by these knuckleheads. He would use these words that were sort of out of touch. And yet it was a kind of common man touch to it. You know, I mean, I would find myself getting enraged by some of these things that happened. And, you know, but he dealt with it in a way that, I mean, it was almost like he felt like they are knuckleheads. So they don't have, like, the common sense, just to deal, like, on a level of a common sense human being. And I wondered how much he really dealt with people in the, the ministry community and otherwise about dealing with that day in and day out.
Well, Rivers said he was there for it. I mean, Marjorie and I have gone to many of the Mother's Day March for Peace events on Mother's Day, which are essentially populated by family members of those who were murdered in and around Boston. And I have to say, you speak to the families of people who you think would be angry at a chief executive who couldn't stop a murder in a city, virtually without exception. Mothers, fathers, siblings talk about how he was at the house. There was no press following him immediately. Mm-hmm. He worked like a dog with Ed Davis or whomever it was at the time. to try to find the killers. I don't think we ever heard a bad word from one of these families. And if anybody has a reason to be angry,
I don't think he knew how much
he did either. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Because he wasn't having a reporter from the Globe or the Herald or whatever trailing him to these houses. Mm. In any case, at 4 o'clock today, he makes the official announcement. You'll hear it live on Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney, thanks so much.
All right,
we'll see
thank
you tomorrow
at 1
o'clock.
Thank you very much for being here, Emily Rooney. You can see her show, of course, every single solitary night, Greater Boston at 7 o'clock on WGBH. And, of course, my favorite show, Beat the Press, Friday night at 7 o'clock. Okay, coming up, we have Adam Riley from WGBH. We're just going to take a brief break from the Tom Menino talk, although maybe Adam's got a few words to say about Tom Menino. But specifically, we want Adam Riley to recap last night's United States Senate debate that I don't think many people even watched. But that's next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Right now, Boston Public Radio is in the middle of a very important fundraising campaign. But even though this program is coming to you fundraiser-free, it's still a great time to do your part, especially because right now, you'll be entered to win a once-in-a-lifetime adventure for two to Hong Kong, courtesy of the Hong Kong Tourism Board and General Tours World Travelers of Keene, New Hampshire. Call 888-897-9424 or enter to win when you give online at wgbhnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Museum of Science, where science and technology come into focus. The Museum of Science is proud to sponsor a night of innovation and big ideas, Thursday nights from 9 to midnight on WGBH Radio. And the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu.
Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Believe it or not, I know you're going to have a lot of trouble with this. Believe it or not, there were two debates in the United States Senate race last night, a Republican debate for 30 minutes, a Democratic debate for 30 minutes. GBH's Adam Riley was there, and he's now here with us. Good afternoon, Adam Riley.
Hey, guys. So I don't get to talk about Menino?
Yeah, actually, if you want to.
Yes. No. Yes. I just partly. We should start off talking about the debates.
But before you do that, actually, since you mentioned Menino, if you could define, let's do a pie of public attention. In Greater Boston, let's say, or at least in Eastern Massachusetts, let's take a little broader, what percentage of the public consciousness is focused on Tom Menino, and what percentage of the public consciousness is focused on the five men who would be John Kerry's successor?
We're talking right now?
Right this moment, as we're sitting here.
I would guess, other than the operatives who are working on the campaigns of the various would-be senators, it's got to be all Menino, right?
I mean, it's like a crime. I really feel bad about this.
I do, too.
There was no interest in this race. They finally do a debate. R.D. Saul, NECN special correspondent, was the moderator. Thought did a great job. Putting that aside, they finally have a debate. And, you know, I was saying to people yesterday, even if nobody watches, the 11 o'clock and the 10 o'clock and 9 o'clock news are going to be led by this. The morning news will be led. That's what we're going to talk about all day on the radio. The newspapers, headlines. And it's literally almost like the debate never happened.
It really is. I was writing up a little synopsis for WGBHnews.org last night at about 11. And it was really hard for me to focus. I kept wanting to go read about the Menino story. It was brutal.
Did your synopsis get shorter and shorter and shorter?
I got out pretty quickly. Once I reached a plausible point to exit,
And by the way, if you happen to watch this thing, or if you have questions about it and couldn't watch it, or were hoping to read about it and didn't, Adam Riley knows everything about it. I actually watch pretty closely, too. At 877-301-8970, give us a buzz. Tell us who you think won, lost, what the impact will be. Let's ask you, on the Democratic side, it seemed to me, did you say this at a staff? I don't know if I'm allowed to say
the morning media. I think we can talk about that.
Say what you
stuff,
said,
right?
About the level of something that changed in this whole thing.
Yeah, well, I thought on the Democratic side that Steve Lynch won handily. And that's mostly because I thought Ed Markey looked like he had, you know that, have you heard about that weird disease called Morgellons where people start to itch because they're so uncomfortable in their own skin?
Oh, no.
I thought he had a case of political Morgellons last
night.
He just, and it may have been the camera angles on the, you know, what we were watching the WCVB broadcast in the CVB media room. I just thought he looked like he wanted to be anywhere but on the stage with Steve Lynch throughout the half hour. And it reminded me of the way Scott Brown looked in that first debate with Elizabeth Warren, where he came in, you know, there was some question about whether he'd be able to make it back from Washington, D.C.
Right.
And I think we were all expecting Scott Brown to look calm, cool, and collected. And instead, he looked kind of twitchy and ill at ease. And I thought Markey was like that last night, but worse.
But see, let me tell you what, I didn't notice, and I'm usually really into the physical feel of a debate, much more than I probably should be.
That's two of
us.
We were
actually talking about the five haircuts last night on my television show, which I'm
Markey
embarrassed.
Markey needs one.
Embarrassed
he needs one.
What about Michael Sullivan's sideburns? But we can get back to those.
Let me tell you what my thought was. Much to the good fortune of, in my opinion, of Ed Markey, the first two questions from R.D. Saul, which I think, frankly, were intentional not to help Markey, but because there's a difference, were on the two liberal liabilities of Steve Lynch in a liberal Democratic primary. You voted against Obamacare and you're pro-life. And even though I think Steve Lynch did a decent job on both questions, when you're back on your heels in the first 10 minutes on the two issues...
Steve Lynch is not pro-life.
No, I've had that discussion with him, but that's not the point.
It's an important point.
Well, it is, except that he says he is pro-life.
Yeah. So he's personally pro-life that he wants to work with.
But the point I'm trying to make is I think he was back on his heels, had to defend himself. Ed Markey was on the offensive, and I think it's hard to ever come out of that.
I think it was a great setup for Steve Lynch, but I don't think he fared as poorly as you do. I mean, I thought he handled the Obamacare question pretty well. I mean, his rationale that it didn't go far enough, that it was,
and
a, giveaway
it was a giveaway to
the insurance
companies.
Right?
That's a good point.
I'm not always convinced when he, because it can get a little torturous sometimes, but I thought he did a terrific job articulating those points last night. And on abortion, I actually thought that he came across as voicing sort of a genuine, ambivalent, deeply felt stance, which he felt was the best compromise that he personally could come to.
But Adam Riley and Mark Regan, that's great for a final election. It's not great for a primary in which the voters are overwhelmingly liberals.
But I would say that voters should pay close attention, because I am certainly very strongly pro-choice. But Steve Lynch's opinion is what Joe Biden's opinion is. He is a personally pro-life, but he's not going to force his pro-life positions on other people.
You think that helps in a primary when the most liberal and the most conservative
voters
vote?
Our voters are smart enough. He's where the vast majority of Americans are.
I think that's true.
And I think that's so. And by the way, he also gets very bad marks from the pro-life groups and very good marks from the pro-choice groups, because he has, as many other politicians have, evolved.
A couple points worth noting. Ed Markey has evolved too. As R.D. Saul pointed out last night, he used to be skeptical when it came to abortion rights.
Three decades ago, though.
Yeah, but I mean, he did not start out where he is today. And also, I think one thing Lynch did well on this particular question was say, I think we should be striving for less abortions, not more. And I think, I have worked with groups like Planned Parenthood because it stands to reason that if you don't want abortions to occur, you want to maximize contraceptive coverage and contraceptive use.
I want to be clear with you guys. If this was a final debate and it was Steve Lynch against the Republican nominee, those answers would have helped pave the way to victory, because you get unenrolled voters and you get some Republican voters.
Oh, okay.
But let me tell you what I thought was the highlight.
What? When you see the commercials, and Lynch's commercials are the best.
They are really good. I like Steve Lynch. I'm going to be upfront about this.
When you see those commercials, came from the projects, strapped on the work boots, all those years as an iron worker, and then you are predisposed to like him better because you feel as though Ed Markey would be yet another rubber stamp vote, as he has been on many issues down in the Democratic Congress. I think the fact that Steve Lynch has a more nuanced view of some things is impressive, not a liability.
One thing, I actually do agree with you that he hurt himself with liberal voters on one particular point,
which was
his going after, what did he say? I'm not going down there to write blank checks for Nancy Pelosi or something like that. And that stuff, when he was talking, kind of picking up Pelosi and other standard issue targets on the left, I remember thinking to myself, well, wait a minute, I could see that if it was a general election debate, but this is the Democratic primary. Why is he doing that? And I think he started to do that and pulled back a little bit.
Lynch, you're talking about.
Lynch.
Okay.
Here was, I thought, the best strategic moment for Ed Markey. There was big disagreement in the newsroom out at NECN. Listen to Ed Markey. They're asking, R.D. Saul is saying, ask a question of your opponent. And most people think, I'm going to do a real zinger. I'm going to expose what's wrong with him. Listen to this question from Ed Markey to Steve Lynch.
Steve, you're a real champion for the VA. I'm concerned about what could happen to our veterans coming back from Iraq and from Afghanistan. Could you tell us how you view what the solution has to be to make sure that the care is there for them after they've served that country?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ed. That's a very kind question.
You know, when I heard the first part when he said, Steve, you've been a real champion, I thought sarcasm was going to come after.
Yeah.
I thought it was brilliant. Everybody is so, Adam's going to yell at me. Everybody is so sick of fighting in politics. When somebody has the even if it's strategic, the grown-upness, if that's a word, to say, you know what, even though I want to beat the you-know-what out of you,
right.
You did great on X, even if you don't believe it, by the way. You don't think the person sitting at home says, hey, there's a mensch, there's a grown-up. No, Adam?
You may be right. I mean, I think maybe those of us who pay really close attention to this stuff, as we all do, you know, when I saw that moment, I thought it was painfully transparent and inauthentic and just, you know, horribly awkward moment in the debate. But maybe you're right. Maybe your Joe average voter or Jane average voter came away from that thinking, oh, that Ed Markey is a nice guy. And as I recall, that poll that came out recently from WBUR and Mass Inc. show that he has some favorability issues compared to Lynch, that Lynch tends to be better liked, yes, by a wider cross-section of people. So that's a good point. Maybe they teed it up and think it's going to work.
People who are listening at 877-301-8970 are about to call or saying, what debate are they talking about?
Yeah, they are.
Dave in the car, you're on with Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy, and Adam Riley from WGBH. Welcome, Dave.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Pleasure.
Congratulations, Dave, for watching the debate. You're a very engaged citizen.
I watched the whole thing, and just to sort of bracket myself, I'm an independent voter. Always have been an independent voter. I would say I'm sort of a social liberal and a fiscal conservative, if you can be such a thing. But in any event, I watched last night, and I was fascinated by both of the debates. First, to talk about the Democrats for a minute, I think that Lynch's ads on television have been brilliant.
I think
brilliant.
They're great too.
Yes,
just it's amazing. And they're so refreshing because, of course, all of us have been subjected to so many negative ads over the last number of campaigns. Now, granted, it hasn't gotten down to a Democrat versus Republican yet, but I think this I Am Stephen Lynch thing is brilliant.
For those who haven't seen it, it's about a dozen people, or maybe half a dozen, saying, I am Stephen Lynch. I am Stephen Lynch. And the final image is Steve Lynch saying, I am Stephen Lynch. And it's pretty impressive.
Just a quick aside, it's interesting. He actually took that strategy from his challenger a few years back, Mac D'Alessandro, who ran those I'm a Mac ads.
Is that so?
Yes, yes. Or if he didn't, you know, there's precedent. And I think Yvonne Abraham from The Globe pointed that out. So he watched what his opponent did and
they're great. And what do you think about the Republican side quickly, Dave?
Well, yeah, so from a Republican side, I thought Winslow clearly was the most articulate. He was the only guy who was smart enough to face the camera, which blew me away.
Yeah.
I mean, Sullivan and Assault from Equal Hazard, I can't remember his name.
Gabriel Gomez.
That's a bad sign.
Hey, Dave, thanks for the call. Dan Winslow, the knowledge gap, was huge.
He was the counsel to William Well when William Well was governor of the
Commonwealth.
He's a former judge. And Scott Brown.
And Scott Brown's campaign, yeah.
And he is a very smart guy.
We at least agree on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
yes, in terms of knowledge base, or at least articulated knowledge base.
He's an incredibly nimble thinker,
yeah.
I think. And he knows a lot.
What is your opinion of the former U.S. attorney's sideburns? That would be Mr. Sullivan.
You know, I tweeted something about this, and I'm going to get into trouble for bringing it up again on air. Maybe a little bushy.
Okay, I love it.
You know what? There was a problem last night, I thought, for Michael Sullivan. When the question that was directed at him by Dan Winslow was, I know you care a lot about the deficit. What do you do about the deficit?
Yeah.
Give me three things you do. The first answer was something about waste. And you can see everybody sitting at home saying, yeah, I'm against waste.
We're all against waste.
And then when he finished his answer, Winslow turns to him and says, okay, what's the second thing? And there was a long pause. And Michael Sullivan said, I'd reduce spending. Okay. Well, I think that's a good way. Now, Gabriel Gomez, here's where Adam and I will once again come to blows.
You're a sucker for empty flattery.
Exactly. R.D. Saul asks a question. So ask a question of your opponents. And Gomez turns him and says, I don't want to get into a fight with my opponents. I want to talk about Markey and Lynch. He says, no, that's if you get into the final. So instead of listening to R.D. Saul, he turned to Dan Winslow, this is Gomez, and did this.
Do Congressman Markey and Congressman Lynch actually favor the budget that just came out of the Democratic Senate?
You'll have a chance to ask them that question if you're the nominee
Dan,
of the Republican Party.
Dan,
do you have a question
Dan,
for Mr. Winslow?
Sir, Dan, do you think Congressman Markey and Congressman Lynch should have to actually answer?
I thought it was clever. Adam thought it was pathetic, correct?
Well, I mean, let's bear in mind that Gabriel Gomez is a virtual unknown who's apparently in third place in this race, right? Has a long way to go to catch Michael Sullivan, has to peel away socially moderate voters from Dan Winslow if he's going to have a chance of doing that. And that exchange just made me think, I mean, you could say it was clever, but it makes me think he doesn't really want to win. I don't think that's the way you make up ground when you've got a little more than a month to go until the
I was on NECN this morning, and I was making a brilliant point, if I say so myself. I was saying, in light of the fact that virtually nobody knows any of these candidates, despite the fact in the BUR messing, Paula was Sullivan 28 to 10 to 8. I can't,
yeah, that's
can't remember
right.
who had 10 and 8.
It was Winslow and then Gomez.
Right, exactly. That the level of not knowing anything about them is so high, if anybody can come up with the money to do television ads, he is probably the winner. And I said Gomez apparently has a lot of money.
He's
that
a very wealthy
second,
guy.
What came up on the screen? The first Republican television ad in this campaign. Gomez can win this thing despite his lack of experience. If Sullivan has no dough and Winslow has no dough and Gomez spends a million or two on television, he's the nominee.
Well, Christopher, I think, points out a very sartorial point from last night. He said, I thought emails, Winslow distinguished himself in the Republican debate and the light-colored suit showed him to be a bit of an iconoclast.
Oh, interesting.
So there you go.
I actually thought that Gabriel Gomez won the tie competition. He had the best tie last night. But I want to contextualize that comment that he made, the non-question that he threw at Dan Winslow, because that my reaction to that was colored by a couple other moments in the debate.
What was that?
There was the moment where, and I can't remember, unfortunately, what the topic was, but remember there was that point where Gabriel Gomez totally, and it's happened to all of us, but his brain
lost
froze.
It.
The Rick Perry
lost
moment.
He lost his train of thought for about 10 seconds.
I can relate to that.
And it was just as it's happened to me too, but you don't want it to happen to you in the midst of
you
a debate.
Do not.
So that didn't make him look good.
No, it did not.
And in addition, I think they were talking about the question of whether Ben Bernanke should be reconfirmed. Mm-hmm. And Gomez said something like, well, that's a question for the Senate and House to decide. And R.D. Saul had to jump in and say, but you're running
you're
for Senate,
be,
correct? Right. Now, the interesting thing is that I think Gomez, I actually thought he was very, very shaky in the first forum at Stonehill College. I thought he started out great last night for the first 10 or 15 minutes. And then I thought it all fell apart in the last half.
Let's go to Paul from Milton. Thanks for calling, Paul. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Adam first, is that W. Bushy or H. W. Bushy?
Very good.
Thank you, Paul.
On the
go ahead.
Sullivan sideburns.
Very good.
I did probably one of the four people who actually sat through the whole hour. I did like Winslow's gray suit. I think that did make him stand out. And he did just
Silver Fox.
Command of the facts, although Gomez has Scott Brown kind of appearance on
he does. Yes, he does.
So, I mean, it's not, you know, the old line is, forget what I said, how did I look? So I guess judging that, Gomez probably did well just by his physical appearance.
How about the Dems?
The Dems. I was, I thought that Steve Lynch, you know, really won the debate hands down. He did one thing particularly outstanding, I thought.
What?
I forgot what the issue was, and he said, well, I'm not worried about taxes there. I'm worried about people unemployed on Blue Hill Avenue.
Good line.
So he's got real specific as to, I forgot the context of the, I remember his answer, forgot the context of the question.
Yeah.
But it's just like his commercials, which I, again, think are outstanding. You know, it reminds me, I guess, of that old program, To Tell the Truth. You know, will the real Steve Lynch stand up? I mean, he picks out people. I don't know where they came from. Do you know who the ad agency is who put that together, because it's so much better than anybody else's. And Markey needs a talk about haircuts. He needs a better haircut. And his angle was not good for his features.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it amazing? By the way,
he needs to comb his hair.
Paul,
back,
thanks for the
like
call.
Like a Rudy Giuliani, right? Get rid of the comb.
Well,
over
clean it up and, around the ears.
Yeah, and just brush it back.
Some wag at NECN said last night that the exact same haircut he had when he went to the Congress 36 years ago.
One thing I want to mention about Michael Sullivan before we run out of time here. It's going to be really interesting if Sullivan wins the nomination to see how he tries to come back to the center to shake the Etch-a-Sketch, if you will, on social issues, because he's really going to be boxed in after this primary on gay marriage and on abortion. As I think you guys know, the Mass, what's it called? The pro-life group.
Citizens for Life.
Yes, thank you. Mass Citizens for Life has actually been urging Democratic voters to re-register as unenrolled so
they
that
can
they
vote
can
in
be
the primary.
For Democrats who are really passionately pro life. And I think that, you know, it could win the primary for Sullivan, but then if he gets to the general, it's going to be, I think, a huge turnoff for the vast majority of the
electorate. Oh, absolutely.
Let's squeeze one more quick one in for Adam Riley here. Grace, we're talking from Rosendale. We're talking about the two debates last night in the Senate race. Hey, Grace.
Hi. I saw the entire debate, and it was very boring, and I have two very superficial, disparate comments.
Go ahead.
Okay.
I think it's pretty insulting that Scott Brown, who cared so much about this state, couldn't even spend an hour watching the debate last night. But number two,
I think that's a little unfair. The reality is he decided
DVD'd
not
it.
To enter the race.
He taped it.
But go ahead. What's your number two?
Michael Sullivan's Boston accent went in and out. And I was just fascinated
Mysterious.
With it. He'd drop his R's, and then he wouldn't, and then he'd drop his R's. It was fascinating.
Any relation to the subjects on which he'd lay it on thick, or was it just no rhyme or reason?
No rhyme. Well, in the beginning, I think it was the first segment, definitely wasn't dropping the R's. The second segment, he was.
Intriguing.
I think.
We're going to go back and we'll look at the tape. Grace, thank you so
much
for the call.
Since Grace just hung up, I just want to say I think I agree a little bit with Grace and her surprise at Scott Brown's stance on the debate. I thought it was odd, waiting to come on here, that he couldn't muster up just like one sort of tepid compliment for the Republican field. I mean, I think his line to you guys was something like, yeah, I'd like to see the ratings on that one. Shouldn't he be working for the team here?
Now, that is a good point, I suppose. Although I can see, went out to dinner in the North End. You could tape it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, let me add
so
my two cents to this. Here's my response, Adam. Yep. I think his analysis would be, I don't want to speak for Senator Brown, he could be a lot more enthusiastic about the Republican field if he didn't watch the debate. In any case, before you go away, I know there's a debate is it just Democrats in Springfield?
I believe it's both tonight.
It is. And is there another major televised debate?
I don't know when the next one comes. I should, and I don't know off the top of my head. But I will say that tonight's debate is being moderated by Jim Madigan.
Who did a nice job.
He did a fantastic job in the Warren Brown debate.
Springfield.
He's very, very good.
Hey, Adam Riley, we're glad you went, so we didn't have to.
You know,
thank you very much, Adam Riley.
Thanks for having me on.
Important, since about 17 people actually watched this debate and 4 called us today, I think we did a real public service by having you here, Adam Riley, to tell us what went on.
But in all seriousness, this is a huge and important race. When these offices don't open for decades, people got to get focused. We only have 33 days left till primary day. Adam, thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Coming up, we're going to talk about Tominino once again, his legacy with Christopher Lydon, and also Christopher Lydon is going to remember the 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, the great Anthony Lewis. Stay with us on 89.7 WGBH.
We've been out at the Euler School in Cincinnati since September, keeping track of a school on the rise. The principal and some other administrators are just hoping they get to stick around.
But regardless, whatever happens, one dead monkey don't stop the circus down here at Euler, and it's a good school.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, one step forward, two steps back. That and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Children's Hospital. From simple treatments to complex procedures, their community of care is accessible with suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians statewide. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And New England Audi dealers, presenting the full line of Audi luxury performance sedans, SUV crossovers, coupes, and convertibles, all with quattro all-wheel drive. You can learn more at newenglandaudidealers.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And last week at this exact time, Christopher Lydon said this. What is the question to which the answer is Tominino? And apparently now we know. Joining
the question
us
is, did we love you, Tom? Thank you. Gracious exit. Good years ahead.
That's what you think that's your sense of him after 20 years? By the way, I should say that's the voice of Christopher Lydon from RadioOpenSource.org. We're going to talk briefly about Tominino, and then Chris is going to join us to talk about the late, great Anthony Lewis.
Because you were running against him.
1993.
So you were a fellow contender back when.
20 bloody years ago.
It was 20 years ago, I know.
Yeah, I have thoroughly good feelings about Tominino as a person. As I said last week, I think the city is not in very healthy shape. Despite those clean curbs and infrastructure very solid, the schools still aren't working in their half the city budget. They are the principal priority, you know, of us as citizens. I think there's lots of room now. It's a little scary. I mean, wide open field means anybody with one or two wards under his feet or her feet can make a stab or dream of getting into the top two. This is the race, the kind of race, though, that produced Kevin White, a field of six or eight or nine people. And it's also what produced Tom Menino.
Is there anybody, Chris Lydon, on the Lydon list who is not making the list that is going to appear every day in the Globe and the Herald as likely challengers? Who's somebody on the margin who has potential to make it into the top two, as you say?
Don't have one. I just hope there is one out there. I don't think we want a Bloomberg, frankly. That is to say, somebody who can buy the office, a monster industrialist type. I don't know that there's a perfect public citizen out there. I hope it's not just counselors. There's not a vast talent there. But I don't know. It's sort of a shock. Patricia White, who's since moved to Newton, told me a month ago he's not going to run.
The daughter of. Didn't she run for something about a decade ago?
She ran for council and didn't quite make it. But she's got the mind of her daddy, and she's very shrewd. But she sensed that, first of all, his health wasn't great and that there was no mandate to do, elect Maria Menino and we'll get something different done. There should be a deep breath here for everybody to consider, a public citizen candidacy. Something like, dare I say, what I ran or John Sears or Ed Logue or others have run over the years. This is an open town.
How many votes did you get again?
I've met 7,460,000 people who voted for me, but that's not what the tally says.
You were the 3.5% man, were you not?
I was, and they can't be wrong, those 3.5%, and they're still growing.
One last thing before we move on to Anthony Lewis, though, and we talked about this a little bit before, Christopher Lydon. I think the big thing that could totally change the city of Boston, and we're a small enough city that it's possible. We're not Philadelphia. We're not Chicago.
Talk to me. I love it.
It's someone that could really change the schools. You bring back the middle class, which has fled Boston. You bring back all the people that move, to go to the Dexter School in grade 1 through 6, and then they test into the Boston Latin School. The schools could revolutionize the city if you got someone
that
with
would
the
be
courage
my ticket,
to stand
and John
up.
Conley wants to do it. I think it'll be fascinating to see if he can make a credible case. His baby girl is at the Trotter School, and he takes her there every morning, and that school has turned around. I mean, that if you could do that in 125 schools, you'd have a brand new city. You're right. That would energize. We live on our reputation as a center of learning. We've talked about this before, but that's why it's so much fun to live in Boston. And yet you have to send your kids, or you move out of the city to give your own pride and joys and education. This is wacky. I think it's
totally
a fundamentally
wacky,
neurotic position for this city to be in. Think how happy we could be to be known as the experimental schoolhouse for all America and, in a certain way, for the world. This is a world that needs new tools to get not only smart and productive, but get happy in a world of wonderful minds. We could be the great little star.
Speaking of wonderful minds, there's another huge figure who left the stage in the past week. Anthony Lewis from the New York Times, from Gideon's Trumpet. His wife, Margaret Marshall, was with us last week. We'll talk about that in a couple of seconds. You have a huge place in your heart and head for this guy, do you not, Chris
Lydon? And a huge debt. And we'll talk about GBH's debt. But let me just say, I've thought for years that the real fun of being president of the United States, Jim Browdy, you've thought about this too.
I have, of course.
But would be appointing Tony Lewis to the Supreme Court. I mean, he was a non-lawyer with a kind of lover's understanding of the living.
And by the way, you do not need to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court.
Of course not.
Go ahead.
But he had a grand historian's understanding of the way the law evolved. Justice Frankfurter said years ago that Tony Lewis knew the cases before the court better than most of the justices did. And then he had this extraordinarily lucid prose with which he decoded the issues for me, age 13, reading the New York Times for the first time. But then it turns out all sorts of people, including my friend Rick Hertzberg at The New Yorker, blogged on this. He always dreamed of being president, wanted Jimmy Carter to appoint Tony Lewis as this sort of teaching judge, a people's man with law and with language.
Carter never got an appointment, though, he wrote. Isn't that
true?
Hertzberg wrote?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you got it. But I just want to say, I knew Tony well, not intimately, but many times in my living room, in his living room, he loved to declaim the great opinions. And none more than Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Massachusetts guy, in the famous Abrams case and Holmes' dissent. It was a free speech case in 1919, World War I, and in which Holmes bellowed that the great test of truth was the free trade in ideas. Here's what he said. That, at least, is the theory of our Constitution. It's an experiment, as all life is an experiment. And with that experiment in mind, we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, unless they so imminently threaten immediate interference with the lawful and pressing purposes of the law that an immediate check is required to save the country. Reading that stuff, Tony liked to say, you felt the hair rise on the back of your neck. And this was Tony's meat. Law. Great judges, too. Great prose. Experiment. Free expression. Dissent. The rights of outcasts in this country, in Palestine, in South Africa. Room for ideas that we hate. And then, of course, thundering prose. It turned out Tony could write thundering prose, too. My favorite Tony Lewis columns, I just want to say, they were unmentioned, curiously, in the Times obit, were his responses to the Christmas bombing of North Vietnam in 1972, the Nixon-Kissinger terror bombing of Hanoi with no measurable purpose or benefit. Peace was at hand, they had told us. The war was all but over, but American B-52s poured it on 2,000 strikes over 11 days, an episode Tony Lewis wrote that will live in infamy. And lest we forget it, Tony kept writing that column every Christmas for a decade. The lesson for Americans, the lessons, he said, were still important. Beware obsession. Beware secrecy. Beware concentrated power. Beware men untouched by concern for the moral consequences of their acts.
Can I hold you there before you mention the second column? Because you mentioned the New Yorker a minute ago. Joining us on the phone is a staff writer at the New Yorker. He's obviously the legal analyst for CNN. He wrote a great book called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. That, of course, will be Jeffrey Toobin. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Jeffrey, good morning.
It's thrilled to be here. So we are obviously doing a remembrance of Anthony Lewis, Jeffrey Toobin. What's yours?
Well, it began in a very straightforward way. I took his class at Harvard Law School. He taught for many years a class called Freedom of the Press, which was basically the story of how the Supreme Court came to defend the rights of newspapers, particularly in libel cases. And it focused in great measure on the famous case of New York Times against Sullivan in 1964, then the Gertz case in 1972. I got to know him there. He was the advisor on my note that I wrote for the Harvard Law Review, which dealt with libel law. And then once I became a journalist, after my brief career as an actual practicing lawyer, he became really a role model and a friend, and we saw each other occasionally, but mostly I think of Tony as someone who invented the field in which I have managed to work for many years, which is covering the Supreme Court as a real institution and of real people, and that, of course, began with his book, Gideon's Trumpet, about the Gideon case.
You know, speaking of Gideon's Trumpet, it's perfect timing. Last week, when obviously before he died, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court, Margaret Marshall, who obviously was Anthony Lewis's wife, was here. And we were talking. We had her in because it was the 50th anniversary of Gideon v. Wainwright and obviously the right to counsel of the indigent in criminal matters. Through the whole interview, she was holding in her hands and touching Gideon's Trumpet and flipping the pages, those sort of things. And finally, we asked her if she'd read a little portion from her book because it was clear she wanted to do that. And here is Margaret Marshall reading from her husband's great book.
You know, he's appealing in front of this trial judge down there, and, you know, the judge says, are you ready to go forward? He says, no. He says, well, Mr. Gideon, with no lawyer, why are you not ready to go forward? Well, says Gideon, the United States Supreme Court says I am entitled to be represented by counsel. You know, at the end of the trial, My husband, who was then working for the New York Times, said to him, you know, Mr. Gideon, do you think you accomplished anything? And he looked at Tony straight in the eye and he said, well, I did, didn't I?
The pride in Justice Marshall's face when she was reading those words, Jeffrey Toobin, was immense, I'll tell you.
Well,
Jeffrey, what was the I don't want to say trick, but he was not about the private lives of justices. He was about the ideas embedded in these contests. And somehow he brought it to life. How did he do it?
Well, I think it was a combination of seeing both the cases and the people behind them and the justices themselves as real human beings. Now, just to fill people in a little bit on the story of Gideon v. Wainwright, Gideon was Clarence Earl Gideon was arrested in Florida. He made that famous statement to the judge, you know, the Supreme Court says I'm entitled to a lawyer. In fact, that was not true at that point. And in a handwritten petition to the United States Supreme Court, the court actually plucked it out of the pile and said, we want to hear this case. They had to appoint a lawyer for him. And the lawyer they appointed for him was Abe Fortas, the famous Washington lawyer who, of course, himself became a justice later in the 1960s. So it was this wonderful combination of a Supreme Court case, but also personalities who before, during, and after would be so important on the court. But I think you can't really talk about Tony and the Supreme Court without talking about the Warren Court and the tenure of Earl Warren as Chief Justice, because this was the time when the court was really a liberal institution. And I don't think it's any secret to say that Tony loved that court, and he loved decisions like Gideon v. Wainwright, like New York Times against Sullivan, like Brown v. Board of Education, of all these cases that expanded the notion of liberty in the United States and protected the oppressed. And that was the time he was covering the court as a daily reporter at the New York Times. But later, as he became a columnist, those were the decisions he looked to as the court became more conservative in the Berger, Rehnquist, Roberts years as sort of the ideal of what the Supreme Court should be.
Jeffrey, I that's brilliant. And I think you're deadly right. He was a kind of voice of the Warren Court. That's often phrased as, you know, the liberal court and as a political tilt. It seems to me really, in hindsight, it was a temperamental identification and a deep emotional optimism that guided him, for example, and above all, maybe William Brennan. These were not radicals. They weren't even wild lefties. They were people who believed in sort of constructive reform. Let's compromise, but let's make things better. We're on an upward incline here, and these reforms are not only they work, they transformed our country in the mid-century.
I think that's right. I would quarrel a little bit and say it was pretty politically liberal. I mean, I think it is not a shameful thing to say that Tony was a liberal or the court was liberal, and it definitely was. I think it's also important to remember the backdrop of the Warren Court was the Cold War. And Earl Warren knew that segregation was a terrible stain on the country's public reputation as we were competing around the world for influence with the Soviet Union. And you could look at many of the Warren Court decisions as an opportunity to simply stop letting the South, and it was mostly the South that brought that were responsible for the cases in the 60s, embarrassing the country in front of the world. And I think Tony, you know, with his incredibly wide-ranging interests, you know, that included foreign policy, that included many things that were not directly related to the Supreme Court, I think he understood that, and the place of the court in both the United States, but really world politics.
By the way, was Loving versus Virginia, the interracial marriage case, was that a Warren Court decision, Jeffrey?
Of course, 1967.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I saw last night, either on your station two nights ago on CNN or one of your competitors, talk about the environment in which the decision was made. Polling at that time, which admittedly was more primitive than it is today, 70-24, the American people opposed the notion of people of different races being able to get married. So sort of not only the courage of that court, but it sort of belies what some of the justices said the other day about America not being ready for gay marriage, so they weren't ready for it either.
Hmm. Wow, that's if it was CNN, it wasn't when I was on, because I don't remember that number. That's a pretty fascinating number. I didn't realize. I certainly knew the South was pretty unanimous against it, but I didn't realize that. I believe 19 states still had. Mm-hmm. Those laws. I mean, again, just a reminder, you know, when Barack Obama's parents got married in Hawaii in 1960, there were people in prison for the crime of doing what they were doing, having an interracial marriage. It's just a reminder of how much this country has changed so quickly.
You know, we're talking with Jeffrey Toobin from The New Yorker, and he's also a legal analyst for CNN. You've all seen him on television a million times. Christopher Lydon from RadioOpenSource.org. I'm interested in both of you, because Christopher Lydon was a reporter for many years at The New York Times. You've been a reporter for most of your life, Jeffrey Toobin. I was surprised, and maybe you can explain it to me, that Anthony Lewis, whom we're talking about, who died this week, great journalist for The New York Times, he did not believe, as a reporter himself, that the First Amendment allowed reporters to resist subpoenas to protect their confidential sources. I didn't know what to make of that. I didn't know it until this week, and I didn't know what to make of it.
Well, Jeffrey, you probably know better than I would just say it's not surprising to me. He didn't want a special privilege. The public interest prevailed. For example, in the Judith Miller case, her assertion of privacy seemed much more, it seemed a narrow interest, and Tony declined to defend it.
But this is a very hard question, legally and politically, the status of journalists in terms of the protection of confidential sources, because there are very few privileges recognized in the law. There's the marital privilege, there's a doctor-patient privilege, and
journalists... Priest and confession?
Priest in confession, and the courts have traditionally construed them very narrowly, because they do defeat the truth-finding function of courts. What makes it even more complicated now is that with the rise of alternative technologies, defining journalist is very different, and I think. You know, one of the things I'd like to know is what do you think of what he would have thought of WikiLeaks? You know, this sort of mad disgorgement of millions of documents. Is that an act that should be protected by the First Amendment? I don't think so, but I have a hard time distinguishing it intellectually from other things that I think should be protected.
Hey, Jeffrey, I think Toobin, it should be protected. I think it would have been right on the line for Tony. I'm not sure.
Speaking of Anthony Lewis, Jeffrey Toobin and Chris Lydon, do either of you have any sense of, other than intuition, as to what Lewis thought of the current Supreme Court? Toobin first. Jeffrey, do you know?
Oh, he did not like Roberts and Alito, and God knows he was long on record for not liking Scalia and Thomas. You know, he believed that the court should have gone back to the Warren Court days, aggressive protection of minorities, including recognizing the need for affirmative action, protection of women's rights, including the right to choose abortion. I did not ever discuss with him gay rights. I mean, I think it is, of course, interesting that gay rights was a subject that at least in the polite company of the New York Times, was barely discussed in the 1960s. You know, Stonewall only took place in 1969. But the notion of the Supreme Court as an aggressive protector of individual rights is something that was at the core of his being, and I think he would have loved the idea that Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, whom he knew, were on the court, but I think he wished they had a few clones, too.
Hey, Jeffrey Toobin, before we let you go, obviously yesterday and the day before were pretty major moments in front of the Supreme Court. The conventional wisdom, if I can describe it that way, is DOMA falls, at least the portion that relates to federal benefits for people who are legally married to someone of the same sex, and that they figure out a way that their decision about Prop 8 is limited to California and they end up allowing gays to marry in California. Is that your assessment of where the court ends up here?
Well, I appreciate you asking me, given my well-known record for predictions and of results. At the
Tony's
Supreme Court.
Was no better, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Yeah, but
it's okay.
I am somewhat more confident about DOMA, that they will figure out a way to get rid of DOMA, at least as far as this case is concerned. That is, they will rule that it is unconstitutional to invade state privileges, or it's unconstitutional to discriminate against gay people in that way. I find the Prop 8 case a lot more mysterious. There are many moving parts in that case. There are procedural issues, there are substantive issues. I don't have a lot of confidence in making any sort of prediction in that case, other than I don't think they are prepared to do Loving versus Virginia. They are not going to say to all 50 states, you have to allow same-sex marriage tomorrow. Jeffrey, maybe they'll do that in 10 years.
Can I console you, Jeffrey, about predictions? I had lunch with Tony on the day that the Supreme Court was considering the Gore Bush v. Gore election. He said, no way Paul Kennedy will
Anthony Kennedy will allow
a Bush victory. And, you know, on our way home, there it was.
He was only wrong by one, actually.
Yeah, I told you he was a kindred spirit of mine.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeffrey Toobin, CNN and The New Yorker, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Final thought on Lewis from you, please.
I want to speak as a newspaper guy, born and bred. I think Tony was left the high water mark in consequential newspaper journalism in our time. Chris Hedges wrote the other day that TV news as a medium began to die when MSNBC dismissed Phil Donahue 10 years ago for his reservations about the war in Iraq. I would say newspapers started their descent into the grave right about the same time when the New York Times sent Tony Lewis into retirement and retained William Sapphire, who thought the war was a great idea. Wait and see, Sapphire wrote. And I wrote to him later, Bill, we waited. and we saw. Tony would have fought it tooth and nail all the way and would be a better country for it.
You said it beautifully. Christopher Lydon, radioopensource.org. You can find him 24/7 there. You can find him here every Thursday. One, Chris, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marjorie and Jim.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely fascinating, Christopher Lydon and Jeffrey Toobin as well. Okay, back to the man of the hour, Mayor Menino. We're going to be joined by all sorts of people from around the city who may be running, who have opinions about Mayor Menino, his legacy, what he meant to the city of Boston. And that's all next on Boston Public Radio.
This hour of Boston Public Radio is coming to you fundraiser-free, thanks to Sarah in Quincy,
and Thomas in West Roxbury,
and Margaret in Sioux Falls, South Dakota,
and the thousands of other WGBH sustainers who keep this station going with small monthly contributions that automatically renew.
When Boston Public Radio can count on your support, you can count on less time fundraising and more Boston Public Radio.
It's easy to sign on as a sustainer.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
And thanks.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the South Shore Music Circus in Cohasset, presenting world-class entertainment for more than 60 years and presenting Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion Radio Romance Tour 2013. Information and tickets at themusiccircus.org. And POV, go behind the facade of the modeling industry by following a deeply conflicted modeling scout and her latest discovery, a 13-year-old girl. Don't miss POV, Girl Model, Thursday at 9 on WGBH 2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. And exactly, let me do a little math here. In 2 hours, is that right? Yes. And 36 minutes, Tom Menino will take the stage at Faneuil Hall and formally announce that he is not running for his sixth term. In the next 35 minutes, we're going to talk to a ton of important voices in and around Boston about this decision and about the future. And the first of those important voices has her own voice, 6:30 on Sunday nights, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Of course, by definition, she would be Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie.
Hello, Jim.
I don't think her mic is on, but it's about to be. Say hello again, please.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie.
TV better the second time.
So okay. What do you think? What
What's Tom Menino mean to you? What's his legacy?
I got something to say about that, but I just want to tag on to Chris Lydon and Anthony Lewis and just say he wrote some of the most wonderful pieces about South Africa. We now, on a time when Nelson Mandela's in the hospital again, you may forget all of that strife and whatever happened during the apartheid states. Anthony Lewis's writings really helped me understand what was happening. It was so fabulous.
From where his wife comes, obviously, yes. Margaret Marshall.
May I tagline on that? Because I was too embarrassed to say it with Christopher Lydon and Jeffrey Toobin here. If you had difficulty understanding the Supreme Court cases, Anthony Lewis wrote
them
so that you could understand them if you were in the sixth grade. And for those of us who struggle with all this legalese, that was such a gift to me.
He was an amazing writer. So yes.
Tom Menino is going to be gone, literally, at 4 o'clock today. What do you take away? What's the memory? What's the sense?
What I take away is his trying to embrace inclusion in the city. Now, I say trying because I think he did some – he made some comments, which is important, just the other day, talked about, you know, what the lack of jobs in certain areas of the city that are mostly minority. And he worked very hard to bring some large conventions here to town to make the point that Boston, the new Boston, is not the old Boston. I think that's all good. I would have liked to have seen his cabinet and some of the other appointments be a little bit more diverse, as we say. And, you know, there's some people that have some issues with him. But as a guy who was out front trying, and I know personally for one of my organizations, the National Association of Black Journalists, he went to the mat trying to get that convention here. Because he said, look, you know, leave that behind. We're trying to make a different statement here in Boston. I appreciate that about him.
In light of what you just said about what you'd like to see that he did but could have done more, who would you like to see be one of the two finalists who ends up in the fall?
No, I think this is going to be really interesting. I feel so sorry for those Senate candidate people because talking about them. Yeah, I watched.
I did watch
the debate.
That means five of us did.
Right. I did watch it. But then the minute this announcement happened, I thought, uh-oh. You know, we're all onto this, and it's going to be that just this passionate of interest up until the time somebody's named. I think there's so many names out there, including somebody that's going to be probably on your show tomorrow and on mine on Sunday, Tito Jackson.
Love him.
He is not commenting now today. He says it's the mayor's day. That's what his official statement says. But a few weeks ago, he said, hey, if the mayor decides not to re-up, I might take a shot at it.
He has got a lot of talent. He's very charismatic. Mm. He's very funny. He's very charming. I mean, I think he is a bright prospect.
He's got a bruising battle. There's a lot of people that want to be in that chair.
He doesn't have any money. Dan Conley, the Suffolk County DA, is one with the most money at this
point. It's going to be interesting.
Hey, speaking of that chair, you're going to be back in that chair tomorrow to talk to us about your weekend show. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Kelly Crossley, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim and Marjorie.
Under the Radar, Sunday nights at
6:30.
She'll preview it tomorrow and she'll be with us tomorrow. If you want to talk about Menino, our number is 877-301-8970. Again, we're going to be joined by a bunch of people, members of Congress, public officials, those who've been critical of the mayor, columnists, and you know, one of the people on this list, by the way, we're going to talk to Peter Kadzis in a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the newsroom upstairs was saying the same thing. How sad that the Boston Phoenix folds the week before Tom Menino, one of the biggest stories.
You can't read that edgy coverage of the mayor Well, I shouldn't say that, but Phoenix did it very well.
In any case, joining us on the phone is the former Suffolk County Sheriff. She's now Governor Patrick's Secretary of Public Safety. That would be Andrea Cabral. Welcome, Secretary Cabral.
How are you?
Terrific. So, Andrea, you're a politician, or you were a politician. Tom Menino's a politician. How did he manage to be so successful? Never was a guy more underestimated. No one says that anymore. What was the key to his success, do you think?
Well, when you're far better than you know, people who would underestimate you, then it's kind of easy to be you know, really good at what you do. But I think he achieved it by being present. He was present. He was engaged. He knew the issues. I don't know of a person in public life who knew the city, who knows the city as well as Tom Menino does. And when you know the city, it's almost like you know. You literally take its pulse every day.
Yeah.
And you really know what's going on in all corners of the city, and you make it your business to attend to matters in all parts of the city. So, I mean, I think his success was in really that the hard work of it was his whole approach to the job was about the hard work of it.
I mean, you were the sheriff of Suffolk County for a decent period of time while he was the mayor of the city. A lot of people think that Tomenino felt there was only room for one politician, one elected official in a room, literally and figuratively. What kind of relationship did you have? Was it collaborative or was it sort of like you do what Tomenino tells you to do?
No, some of the best things that we did with the city of Boston. I mean, a lot of Tomenino was probably one of the first mayors in this state that sort of began to recognize the need for reentry programs, which were really where we turned our focus in the sheriff's office, because it became so much about what people did, the choices they made once they were released, and the opportunities they had. And he became such a big fan of reentry programs because he could see the decrease in recidivism. He could see the impact that they had on communities, and you could actually change people's lives. And so we worked with him directly on a lot of that stuff, but on with the agencies of the city of Boston on many, many aspects. And so we've been collaborating with them for quite a while.
Last question for me, Andrea Cabral. I haven't spoken to you since you've been Secretary of Public Safety, except to congratulate you. You made my personal short list of three people most likely to declare for this race in the near future. Was I right or was I wrong?
I think you were wrong. I think I'm the public safety secretary. Like, did you miss that part where you congratulate me on having this job?
You'd make some
news.
And then
suggest that I go do no. I work for Governor Patrick, and I'm very happy here. And I just wanted to. I appreciate the thanks. I appreciate the congratulations. But I committed to him to be here for 2 years. I've only been here for 2 months. I'm really just getting started, and there's a lot to do, and there's a lot that he wants to get done. But I will say about Tomenino that I do hope that the city engages in repeated rounds of thanks, because the city looks the way it looks today because of Tomenino,
yeah.
And that absolutely cannot be denied. You might not be able to say it about a lot of people, but he did build that. He did. You have to acknowledge that he did build it, and he put his heart and soul into building this city. So I want to thank him, and wish him well, and wish his family well, and thank you for your congratulations. But
I was wrong yet again, Andrea.
Andrea Cabral, Secretary of Public Safety and former
Thanks,
Suffolk
Secretary.
County Sheriff. Thank you so much for being with us. On the phone with us now is Congressman Michael Capuano. Thank you very much for joining us, Congressman.
Always a pleasure, Marge.
So you got a good Tomenino story, Congressman?
If I do, I'm not telling them.
By the way, for those who don't know, Boston is in Mike Capuano's district. In many ways, and I mean this, well, I don't know if I mean it as a compliment. I think I do. You and Menino are described in very similar ways, Mike Cap. I'm serious. As sort of tough guys, you like to be in charge. You like to be the boss. You were obviously the mayor of Somerville before you're a member of Congress. Did you guys, I'm serious, did you get along well, or was there a head knocking kind of thing?
No, just the opposite. We get along very, very well. Being, I think, a former mayor, number one, and number two, not living in the city of Boston, I think put me in a great position to get along very friendly with Tom for a long time. Actually, since he was at the State House, I've known him an awful long time.
How did he treat you as a fellow? I mean, I forgot about this. Not only were you a mayor, weren't you head of the mayor's group for a little while?
Yep. Yes.
Was Tomenino the big dog and there was everybody else, or did he play the game with all of the, I guess, the lesser city mayors, people like you?
It's like everything else. It depends on the issue. I mean, cities are cities. We generally, wasn't a competition. I don't remember ever being in a competition with another city as a mayor. On occasion you would compete to try to attract a business or something, but we generally had issues like state aid and education reform and pension reform and things like that. I can't think of any situations where we weren't on the same page.
You know, I asked you, Congressman Capuano, if you had a favorite story. You said you weren't going to tell me, but give us a good, I mean, there must be, when you think of Tomenino, what do you think of? What are you going to remember him for?
Well, lots of things. First of all, he's still alive.
He is.
Yes, he is. And kicking.
Hopefully a lot. Look, because I was a former mayor, we saw things very much the exact same way. I mean, it sounds silly, but he knew then, and he will absolutely live it in the not-too-distant future, that once you're a mayor, you are always a mayor. You always look at potholes. You always look at little things on the street that a lot of political people don't see because they weren't, they weren't trained that way.
Right.
I used to drive around in the old days before all the fancy technology with a small little tape recording machine in my car and just tape record little notes. You know, this tree needs to be trimmed, this curb cut needs to be, things like that. And I know that, he does it a different way. Obviously, it's a new world. But it's the same concept. You look at things completely differently when your job is to take care of those things in a direct responsibility.
And, you know, when you talk to people in Boston about those sorts of little things, that is a big deal. The trash is always picked up at the right time. The parks.
Emily Rooney told the story before about telling about a water fountain that was overturned. He wrote it down on a piece of paper and it was fixed the next day.
But, you know, before he became mayor, the joke in Boston was all the nice parks were in South Boston because they're very politically wired. Now there are nice parks all over the city of Boston. That's a big deal.
It's a really big deal. It's also, in my opinion, the sign of a great mayor. Every city has neighborhoods, and then neighborhoods within neighborhoods that think that somehow they have been overlooked, and sometimes they have been. I don't think you can find any place in Boston that would say that. I mean, you'll find some neighborhoods that didn't like some things the city administration might have done, but they can't say that they were overlooked or that the mayor didn't pay attention to them.
Before you go away, Mike Capuano, who is a better mayor, you or him? Come on.
Today I'm going to give it to Tom Menino.
Mike Capuano, congressman, represents Boston. We really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Joining us on the phone now is Peter Gelsinas, who is a columnist at the Boston Herald, who has lived his entire life in South Boston, where I just said they used to have the best parks in the city until Tom Menino came along. And then maybe, you know, West Roxbury and Roslindale got a couple of nice parks. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
Good afternoon, folks. How you doing?
Were you surprised last night, Peter? I don't know what time. Everybody seemed to have heard 5, 6, 7 o'clock. Were you as shocked as I was or no?
No, I was. I think there was a bit of, the sense of inevitability, but also some melancholy. I mean, he's been a fixture in our scene for 20 years. So I think you kind of knew. You know, you didn't want to admit the obvious that it was going to be very, very difficult for him to try to go forward. But at the same time, you had to, you know, I think one of the testaments to him that even with a cane, you know, he dictated reality. Nobody was going to do anything until they heard from him, you know, even given whatever he's battling physically. And I think that's a testament to his power, you know.
You know, Emily Rooney says she's totally convinced. She was with us about an hour ago. It is all about his health. Were it not for a conversation with his doctors, that Tom Menino would be gone for number six. Are you in that camp, Peter Gelsinas?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. Because, you look, he's a plugger. You know, I mean, the interesting thing about him is that, you know, nobody will ever confuse him with the elan of Kevin White.
Right.
And yet, I think he took Kevin White's downtown game to a whole new level, while at the same time mastering the lessons that he learned from Flynn in terms of, you know, lunch bucket compassion. I mean, he played both of those things marvelously. And yet, you know, he wasn't a flashy guy. I mean, he wasn't Bloomberg and he wasn't this kind of thing. But you just couldn't deny him. He would not be denied, you know, and he knew everybody in every corner of the city that he needed to know. And he knew them personally, and he could get them in an instant.
So Peter Gelsinas from the Boston Herald, how would you compare the city of Boston under Ray Flynn, under Tom Menino? Who had more success turning the city around?
Well, I think it's been a process of evolution. I think, you know, I was talking to Mel King yesterday, and he talked about the idea that they needed a course correction after Kevin White. They needed to go into the neighborhoods and kind of give them a sense of empowerment and work the neighborhoods. I think that was Ray's contribution, pivotal contribution at that time. You remember when Menino came in, you know, the term he used to describe himself was urban mechanic. So you know, he followed that in a very kind of smooth, inevitable way. But at the same time, look what he's done. You know, there was a lot of seeds planted, particularly, let's say, in the Southie waterfront, as to what was going to happen. Yet he jumped right into that, and his hand in sculpting his part of the skyline. You know, when Kevin went out, the idea was, you know, the skyline that Kevin built. Well, you look at that, you know, it's been doubled. And some people will say maybe it's time for another kind of course correction. Mel King was talking about that a little bit yesterday, that there are movements out there now called Right to the City, which is the idea that you have people who now, because the city's become such a desirable place to live, are, you know, people on the edges are being pushed out to the exurbs. You know, they're going down to Randolph, and they're going into Brockton, and they're going into Avon, because they can't afford to live here anymore, even in Roxbury and Dorchester and places you didn't think were necessarily as valuable. They're all valuable now. So it creates a different kind of dilemma, you know, and maybe, you know, I think, but all of that, I think, was part of the fact that, you know, all of this activity happened certainly under his reign, and he was capable of drawing from both his predecessors. You know, he learned from them, and he mastered both styles really effortlessly.
I love how you said...
But he did it, like I said, he wasn't, you know, people... You know, ribbed him about his eloquence, and you know, and he ribbed himself about his physical appearance sometimes. But he, you know, there was nobody shrewder in terms of understanding the value of cities, and realizing, you know, how to move that whole dynamic forward.
Peter, I love that you said under his reign. That was perfect. Peter Gelsinas.
Yeah, I mean, he's like Tito, you know? I mean, nobody was screwing him, you know? I mean,
Peter Gelsinas. Hey, Peter, thanks so much, columnist for the Boston Herald. We really appreciate your time. Now joining us on the phone from the other major paper in town, he's the editor, but he returned to his roots today, a great front page column, Brian McGorry. Good afternoon, Brian.
Good morning, Jim. How are you? How are you, Marjorie?
I'm great, Brian. You did write a great piece today. And you had, toward the end of your column this morning, a little scene setter about the mayor sitting alone in his office on the fifth floor of Government Center with the windows closed, with the windows open and the door closed. Tell our listeners what he said to you.
Well, he was talking about the many nights he spends, the many evenings he spends alone in his office, the door pulled shut, the staff long gone, the security detail waiting for him down in the horseshoe downstairs, and he will be sitting there in that fifth floor office, which, Marjorie, you had a terrific column today. You've been in that office with the soaring ceilings and the cement and paneled walls and the picture window that looks like you're all but in Quincy, in the Quincy marketplace, and looking out at the harbor. And he sits in that oval table in the window, and he just talked about what it's like to be in there with nobody else around, knowing this is my city. I'm the mayor of this city, and how chilling that can be, even 20 years in.
The exact line in your piece, and you think I'm the mayor of this city, it sends chills up your spine.
Which sent chills up my spine, really, just reading it.
Hey, Brian, you were with him yesterday, correct?
I was, yes.
Did he tell you when you were with him, I'm not doing this anymore? He didn't, did he, or did he?
He didn't tell me in those exact words. He was conveying the message every other possible way. He felt he needed to sit down and talk with the staff and let them know personally before it was in the pages of the Globe. And I honored that, I tried to honor that. We ended up breaking the news last night later in the evening. I kind of let him do it his way.
Brian, what's the one memory you take away? You were in this town for virtually, other than your, I guess, your time in Washington, virtually the whole mayoralty of this guy. What do you take away? What's the one thing you take away?
I mean, a specific anecdote or a more thematic
whatever
either.
Approach?
Either
you
or.
You pick it.
There are too many. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start. As I said in print today, it's the guy who is in a daily gladiator fight with English language, who is presiding over a city that is perhaps the intellectual capital of America. It's the guy who is so thin-skinned, and yet he is so well-loved all across town. The guy who is derided as not having vision is now presiding over a city that exudes vision, and that's really true. It was never a clean fit, and somehow it all fit very, very well together.
Brian McGorry, you wrote it beautifully. You set it beautifully. Brian McGorry, editor of the Boston Globe, great column on page one today. Brian, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to a handful more people who know Mayor Menino pretty well, have either covered him, have criticized him, have supported him, and we're going to play a brief excerpt from Tom Menino as the Godfather at a great event a couple of years ago. That's all coming up right here on Boston Public Radio.
Jim McGreevy had it all, a big job as governor of New Jersey, a beautiful wife, two beautiful kids, until he had an affair with a man on his staff and had to resign.
God willing, since that time, I've hopefully stumbled in the right direction.
Jim McGreevy's next chapter is the subject of a new documentary, and we'll hear about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the 2013 MKZ Hybrid, a luxury car with an EPA-estimated 45 city miles per gallon. More information at lincoln.com. Actual mileage will vary.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marg Regan. 2 hours and 15 minutes, Mayor Menino makes it official. In the interim, we're talking to a lot of people who know him, work for him, covered him, that sort of thing. Tom Menino, this is a Tom Menino you didn't know. At an event that Marjorie and I co-emceed for Mass Inc., a nonpartisan think tank in Boston a couple of years ago, Tom Menino agreed to do a scene from The Godfather as The Godfather. If you missed it, here's a piece.
We've known each other for many years. This is the first time you came to me for advice. You've always gone to the empty suits of the media. I can't remember the last time you invited me for Dunkin' Donuts or a cup of gold or sandwich.
Commendatore, I ask your friendship.
Thank you.
I look forward to the day when we break cannolis at the Modern Pastry.
Cannolis are nice, but one day I will also ask you for a favor like providing 10,000 summer youth jobs. I'll put a Hubway bike rack in the lobby of the International Palazzo. Now I must go. Leave the blueprint. Take the cannolis.
Leave the blueprint. Take the cannolis. And by the way, that was an unnamed, very famous caricature of a very famous developer in town.
And it was
written the other character.
By Anthony Nunziante.
A wonderful person at City Hall. We're going to continue our discussions with people who knew him, who worked with him, some who are critical of him. Joining us next on the phone, is this Greg now is with us in a minute? Is that his Greg Selko is the owner of Karma Loop, which to my daughter is the most important thing he does. To others, he's the founder of the Future Boston Alliance. Greg, thanks so much for joining us on Boston Public Radio.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Now, you worked for the guy. He went to your wedding. You used to have a really close relationship, but then you became a critic, Greg Selko, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, I voted for him 4 out of 5 times, and I knocked on doors for him. And, generally, I think he's been a very strong mayor, and I've never said otherwise. I certainly thought his heart was in the right place, and he was motivated by the right things. But, yeah, I had some policy differences and some differences of opinion.
Like what? Because it's been a love fest here today, Greg. Give us a couple of criticisms of the mayor.
Well, I mean, look, so I want to do it in a way that's respectful because obviously this is an important day for him and he should, as I said, hold his head high. He's done a lot of good things. I think, without getting into too many details, I think there were issues around talent retention and issues around licensing and fairness with how building and development was done in Boston, the city's engagement with the Public Transit Authority, which is a state agency, which they kind of took a hands-off approach. I think the my biggest issue with him was just his style in terms of it was very much in a sort of are you in or are you out sort of culture in the city, and I didn't think it was fair. But I mean, again, at the same time, I think that he this is a day that he should be very proud. He spent 20 years here. He's done a lot of good work. I think one of the things that I always wanted to stress is it wasn't a personal thing. It was really just, my feeling as someone who's been a lifelong resident of Boston, who cares a lot about Boston and who's built a business here, that there were some things that I thought weren't happening. And I wanted to be, one of the problems in Boston over the last 10 years in terms of the public discourse is there's very few people who are willing to speak out and be critical. And being critical doesn't mean that you hate someone or you have to be at odds. And I felt that part of the problem was that was sort of the standard now in Boston, which is that if you're critical of the mayor, then you're his enemy. And I don't think, that's a healthy thing for the city. So
that's why you had to move to Ohio. Is that correct, Greg?
That's right, exactly. I moved to Ohio. Somehow I still was getting, they put a boot on my car in Ohio. He's got far-reaching power and friends.
Hey, Greg Selko from the Future Boston Alliance in Carmeloop, we really appreciate your time. You were respectful and you were very diplomatic. Thanks so much, Greg. We appreciate it. Joining us on the phone, we were talking about how sad this is. Not only do we both love the Boston Phoenix and love the former executive editor of the Boston Phoenix, to go out of business the week before the biggest political story in a quarter of a century, having said all that, the former executive editor of the Boston Phoenix, Peter Kadzis.
Well, here I am, and I got to say, I don't think there's anyone I've written more critically of than Mayor Menino, and no one who I've enjoyed a better relationship with.
Why is that? What does that say?
Really? Sure. I mean, we've whacked him all the time. Why? Because I'm always respectful. And that's me. Listen, I'll tell you why. Just hold your breath and listen to this. Menino, you see, he mastered the art of being underestimated. Wasn't as slick as Kevin White or as emotionally intense as Ray Flynn. Menino's essential guys of just being a regular guy who worked hard to do the right thing, more or less snowed the daily press and the local TV stations. And he did it for 20 years. Now, some of that's going to change. As I understand it, the Globe Spotlight team is preparing a big report on the BRA. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Menino's key tool for governing were three big annual speeches: State of the City, the Municipal Research Bureau, and the Chamber of Commerce speech. Now, today I did some quick calculations. In over 20 years, he announced about 600 initiatives, breakthroughs, and new directions. Now, including a promise to be open to new ideas and to curb his famous temper, which, of course, was only displayed publicly. Now, most, but not all of those 600 initiatives remain unmeasured, unreported on, forgotten. You know, you remember those 10,000 new trees, the canopy of green?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
How about the new skyscraper in the financial district?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's not the point. Menino was a better political showman than Curley, than White, than Flynn. In public, he was an optimistic urban leader, you know, sort of a local Ronald Reagan. In private, he was a ruthless micromanager who rarely took his fingers off the levers of power. You know, Tip O'Neill used to say it was blue smoke and mirrors. You know, that was the art of politics.
Yeah.
No one blue smoke rings better.
Hey, Peter, on that note,
that's great.
Peter Kadzis, former executive editor of the Boston Phoenix. We'll see you plenty here on Boston Public Radio. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Peter. You're going to find some place to write that down as well. Absolutely. Okay, next on the line with us is Joyce Faribault, who is a longtime Boston resident, a political analyst. Your late husband was a city councilor for many, many years, Bruce Bowling. Joyce Faribault, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Marjorie, Jim. I am so loving you guys on 89.7. Whoa!
Thank you.
We're loving you, loving it, Joyce. Thank you.
And it's like my wake-up coffee, honest to God.
Well, thank you. But Joyce, you have watched a million races, though, and you're very intimate with the city. What's your big memory? Well, I shouldn't keep saying memory. He's still here. But what's your big moment in the Tom Menino 20 years running the city of Boston?
I don't know. I'll tell you my latest one.
Okay.
Of course, you know my husband, Bruce Bowling, first president of the city council, passed away about 6 months ago. And, you know, a lot of stories were circulating around just before he passed about the condition, you know, that he was in and what was happening and so forth. And I recall getting two calls from the mayor. I couldn't return them back. And the last one was, listen, I really want to know how he's doing and what I can do to help. And I came to meet him. I told him I did not know whether Bruce was in fact going to make it. I saw tears rolling down his eyes, honestly. Mm. The guy was just gregarious and genuine. I think that, you know, I just heard Greg Selko talking about thin-skinned and that. But, you know, all politicians are that. Are you kidding me? If you've got it's a contact sport. It's a Coliseum sport. Of course you watch for somebody who's, you know, throwing out negatives. But the city, honestly, has been really better for some of the work that he did. I remember when I was working with the Boston Prevention Center before it was actually built, and I don't know whether you guys remember this, but Jim Kelly was at the time saying that Menino had promised this, that, and the other thing to South Boston, and the mayor was like, well, geez, I don't remember doing that. And they were back and forth. And I know he, you know, I saw him at an event at Daryl's Bar and Grill, and I slipped him a note, and I said, hey, listen, you know, when it all is over and done, you're going to be one of the greatest mayors, if not the greatest of all, because, you know, you tend to the business of the city in a very fundamental way that is an everyman kind of way. And I'm sure you'll remember that note. To be honest with you, also, in my heart, I felt that he shouldn't run. I knew he was sick. I went through it with my husband, and it could have been just me, you know, kind of over, you know, looking at it. But,
no, I think a lot of people, Joyce, I think a lot of people thought that, too, that he had significant health problems and that it's gone the way it should have gone. But, Joyce, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, Joyce.
Joyce Faribault. And last today, former president of the Boston City Council and longtime city councilor, that'd be Councilor Michael Ross. Hey, Michael, how are you?
How you doing? What a great show you guys are putting out there. And boy, does Peter Kazis have a future in radio?
Isn't he great?
He's spellbound.
Isn't
or maybe
he great?
Even in journalism.
Okay, so, Michael Ross, are you running?
Today is Tominino's day.
Good answer, Mike Ross.
It really is. You know, we've been talking about him all day long. I don't know if you know this. You know, first of all, he's touched this city in every possible way, in any measurable area. I mean, you look at public safety, the plummeting crime rate. You look at the fact we just opened the first or announced the opening of the first elementary school downtown since the Carter administration. Look at the cranes on the skyline. And more importantly, what's happening in the neighborhoods. I don't know if you know this. My first job in government was creating the city's website right out of college. It was 94. I graduated in 93. I created cityofboston.gov in 94. And I applied for a job as a staffer in Tominino's office, not knowing the man and not coming from a political environment. And I got the job. And I then, for the next 2 years, received a PhD in politics. And, you know, working in a, you know, one of those amazing front row positions with a young, you know, staff running advance and doing all that stuff. I would, you
have 30 seconds, Mike, by the way, I'm sorry.
No problem. You get someone's, when they're in front of the camera, when they're in front of an audience, you know, you see one side. When you go behind closed doors and you're in the office and you see the way that person treats the staff, I will tell you, I was inspired to later on run myself because of the guy that was in that seat and is in there today, and he's a great man, and we'll have a lasting legacy in our city.
Nicely
Michael,
said, Councilor Michael Ross.
And
we'll
much.
Ask you the first question sometime in the very near future.
Yes, you will.
Councilor.
Sounds good, Jim.
I think
Michael
more
Ross.
Than once.
All right, Marjorie, sounds good.
To Mike Ross, Callie, Emily, Andrew Cabral, Greg Selko, Congressman Capuano, Brian McGorry, Peter Kazis, Peter Galzinis, Joyce Faribault, Senator Scott Brown, all of you for weighing in on Tominino. In 2 hours, WGBH will have live coverage of the mayor's 4 p.m. press conference. Thanks to all of you who contributed and listened today. Speaking of Tominino, tomorrow our All Menino News Quiz.
I can't wait.
With two members of the Boston City Council competing, Felix Arroyo Jr., Tito Jackson. They'll be in studio playing our game. Again, the All Menino News Quiz. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Thanks so much for being here. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan, and thank you also for being here with us.
See you tomorrow at noon, and make sure you listen today at 4.